from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. It's not every day that a billionaire former hedge fund manager joins an environmental protest, but here was Tom Steyer on February 17th addressing the massive climate rally on Washington's National Mall.
We can't afford 40 more years of dirty energy.
In recent years, Tom Steyer has emerged as a political force in California, backing two successful environmental ballot measures, and now he is taking a greater role on the national stage, particularly in the fight against global warming. And he was even in the running to be President Obama's energy secretary. He'll join us in studio in the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. San Francisco billionaire, investor, philanthropist, and environmentalist Tom Steyer has emerged as a political force in California in recent years. In 2010, he funded opposition to a ballot initiative that would have suspended the state's greenhouse gas emissions law, and that effort was successful. Last year, voters approved Steyer's Proposition 39, which closed the corporate tax loophole to finance $2.5 billion in clean energy and energy efficiency. Now, the former hedge fund manager is taking a greater role on the national stage, particularly in the fight against climate change. He was even in the running to become President Obama's next energy secretary, and Tom Steyer joins us in studio for this forum hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Let me just talk about a little bit of your bona fides first. Founded Farallon Capital in 1986, major Democratic donor. See, this is some of the things I didn't touch on. Funded the state propositions, which I did touch on, actually with his brother Jim, who's been featured on the show a number of times, started a nonprofit, a Center for the Next Generation, which has a lot to do with education. His wife founded One Pacific Bank. I mean, the list is really quite impressive, quite extraordinary. That's a community bank, in fact, community development bank. But right now, what's top on your agenda is global warming and climate change.
That's right. You know, when I left Farallon at the end of the year, I had a number of things that I wanted to do with my time, including working on energy and climate. And over the last 2.5 months, I've not found time to do anything but energy and climate. So I've been voting with my feet. I've spent all my time on it.
Well, it's a big job. And in fact, it took you to Washington talking about the Keystone Pipeline, which, of course, we've featured a lot of shows on, particularly every time Bill McKibben comes on. You spoke at the mall. We heard a little bit of that in D.C., people calling for stronger national climate policy. And you've even gotten into the Massachusetts race now, huh?
Well, the Massachusetts race to replace John Kerry in the Senate has two Democratic congresspeople, Ed Markey and Steve Lynch, trying to represent the Democratic Party in the election. And Ed Markey is he's the name in Waxman Markey.
Yeah.
And he's one of the strongest advocates for sensibility on the climate in the country. And he's done a great job. And Steve Lynch has publicly supported the Keystone Pipeline, and we've asked him to change that stance, and otherwise we'll work hard for Ed Markey.
Well, Steve Lynch has said publicly it will provide, that is, the Keystone Pipeline will provide thousands of jobs, and you say what to that? Where are those thousands of jobs, basically?
Well, what we really say is this. We're pushing for the United States to take a different attitude towards energy and climate, and if we do that, it's going to create millions of jobs. Not hundreds of jobs or thousands of jobs. What we have to do as a country in order to address our energy needs in an intelligent and thoughtful fashion is going to involve redoing a lot of the commercial office buildings. It's going to involve redoing a lot of the existing pipelines and distribution systems. And those are all well-paying, great jobs for Americans that can't be outsourced.
And yet a lot of Americans are skeptical where all these green jobs are going to come from because they've been promised for a number of years now, or they've been talked about at least with the rhetoric for a number of years.
That's absolutely true. There's been an over-promising and an under-delivering. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at what we've actually done, we haven't retrofitted the office buildings and commercial establishments of the country. We haven't redone the distribution pipelines around the country. So the things that will create the jobs, that have to create the jobs, haven't been done. We haven't addressed the problem.
Well, you're preparing, I think, or you're in the process, you and folks you work with are preparing a paper on the costs of inaction on climate change. This goes back to the 2006 report by Nicholas Stern. I think it's going to be that type of report.
Yes. In 2006, Nicholas Stern prepared a report to show the costs of inaction on energy and climate for England, for Great Britain. And we intend to do the same thing over the next year, which is to say, we don't want to look at this as purely an environmental question. Let's look at the hard business economics of this. Let's see what it'll cost us to do the right thing. I actually think it will make our economy stronger, but we're going to look at this systematically. And let's see what it'll cost us to do nothing, because people want to say, oh, we can't afford to do anything. The fact of the matter is, we can't afford not to do something. I think what we're going to find is that the costs of not taking action are extremely high.
Our guest this hour, Tom Steyer, here in studio, philanthropist and environmentalist and founder and former co-managing partner of Farallon Capital Management, which was, I believe, the most successful hedge fund in the United States. Two big problems. Let's talk about them. And they've come up on this program whenever we talk about climate change. Making people believe, making people feel that climate change is actually real and is going to affect them. And also overcoming just the kind of apathy and unconcern.
Okay. Can we talk about those?
I want to talk about them with you. Absolutely. That's why I bring them
believe.
Up. I'll get to the second point in a moment, but yeah.
What the idea of global climate change and trying to make people believe in it is a loser. Just start with that. It's something that's too big for people to comprehend. It's too overwhelming for people to believe they can have any impact on. The fact of the matter is, what people can understand is what's happening in their local environment and how it affects the people they know and their families. So global climate change really is something like an 11th grade science class lecture. What you can talk to people about who live in California is what's going to happen if we have a huge drought and we can't get enough water. You can talk to people in St. Louis about what happens if the Mississippi dries up and we can't get any barges. There's not enough water to send barges up and down the river. You can talk about local things. You can talk about how it impacts the local economies and jobs. And you can talk about how it impacts the health of the people who they love.
When you talk about talking about these things, you mean through education, through dissemination of information, but also maybe through grassroots activism, don't you?
Well, of course I do. Let me say this. In the campaign in 2012, there were some very strong lessons to be learned. And one of them was that people tune out most ads on TV. I think that what really worked in
20... All those negative political ads don't have an effect, I thought.
Well, let me say, I have a further point about that. But what really worked in terms of getting people was actually door-to-door campaigns, coalitions of people who they could trust, and online stuff. The TV ads that broke through were provocative. So when you say, oh, you know, negative ads, are you saying negative ads don't work? Provocative ads that people will actively go seek actually had impact. But the generic political ad where you say, vote for Michael Krasny, he'd be terrific for California, people just absolutely flip through and don't watch.
The other problem that I've found through the years in approaching climate change policy and changes in policy and so forth, we just had Al Gore on talking about this with him, is just the difficulty in getting other countries on board. I mean, the United States, in many people's minds, should be the leader in this. And the United States, in other minds, would suffer by being the leader. Manufacturing and technology, for example, when you led your fight for the first proposition, were very upset. And they were upset because they felt that it was having a big impact on them, obviously. But you've got countries like India and Brazil, China for that matter, who say, well, you know, we're third world countries, but now it's our turn. You guys did all the CO2 release. Now let us have equity on that.
Well, let's start with the question about whether the United States is in an intellectual or moral position to lead on this. When we have the most CO2 emissions per capita of anybody in the world, that doesn't put us in a strong position to jawbone other people to change. I think for us, first of all, I am a believer that the United States has to lead on this. But I also believe that before we can be an effective global leader for this global problem, we have to make a significant turn in our thinking. We have to make a decision that this is really important, and we have to change what we're doing so that when we go to China and India, we have moral and intellectual credibility, and we also start to do the technology work that will say to them, we're not asking you to stay in a poor state. we have the technology that enable you to live a better life in a clean way. So we have to go at this in a systematic and forceful way or we won't succeed.
Our listeners may not even know this, but the Los Angeles Department of Water and Flower, Water and Power, announced just yesterday that it would be coal-free within 12 years. How significant is that, do you think?
I think it's absolutely huge. I'm incredibly happy and excited about it. That is the last major coal market in California. California has had the most progressive energy laws and regulations of any major government in the whole world.
We're the model.
We are the model. And so I think it's absolutely fantastic that Mayor Villaraigosa has done this, that we're going to get off. They were using about 40% of their electricity generation was from a couple of coal plants from out of state. And the fact that we're going to get off that is going to free up the ability to sell cleaner energy and create new businesses and is going to be terrific. So I look at this as a lot of this, instead of being business, I hate business versus the environment. That is a terrible way to think about this. It's really a question of old business, dirty business versus new business. And the problem politically is new business doesn't have a lot of lobbyists. It isn't already really rich. It's looking to the future. So when you think about this, we've got to get out of the frame of it's the environment versus jobs. It's really new jobs and future jobs against jobs of the past.
Or how about, I mean, the way they do it, for example, in Holland, where they have business and environmentalists sit down together and actually try to work through some of the things that may be in opposition or in contention.
Well, my strong belief in this—
Along with policymakers.
Yeah. My strong belief in this whole situation is that American business is going to be the solution. I mean, I really believe that if we can put in place the correct incentives and policies, that people are going to be working their derrieres off to be able to create the new businesses and create a whole bunch of money for themselves. Completely selfishly, they'll have the right incentives to create the right businesses to get us the energy we need in the way we need it.
Well, let's go back a little bit with you, Tom. You fought Proposition 23 with George Shultz and others back in 2010. It would have essentially suspended California's climate change law. And then, in fact, I ought to bring this in again, $32 million spent in 2012 on Proposition 39, going up against the petrochemical and oil companies again and so forth. And soundly defeated, we should add, Prop 39, the opposition. You soundly defeated the opposition. In fact, I think you, even when you saw that the polls were going your way, decided let's keep the money in there and put more money in there to make sure it's a lopsided victory, which it was. What about initiatives, though, affected to such a great degree by people like yourself who have a lot of money? I mean, it could be the Koch brothers. It could be, George Joseph, Molly Munger, whatever. A lot of people find that very disturbing. That's not what the initiative process initially was supposed to be all about, big money. And in fact, big money is controlling too much politics as it is, so the argument goes. And you may remember reading about Hiram Johnson's intention with the initiative, you know, was go after the railroad barons.
I share that concern. I share that unease. But let me just draw one distinction between the two things that I've done, which is to fight against Prop 23 and to fight for Prop 39. In both of those instances, I think what we were doing was completely in the spirit of the original spirit of propositions, which is the people using the propositions against the interests. In Prop 23, oil interests wanted to overturn the rule, the laws that had been put in place by the legislature that represented the will of the people of California. I was really trying to fund the people of California against specific economic interests who wanted to overturn laws that were against their bottom line. In 39, what I was trying to do was make out-of-state corporations pay their fair share of taxes just the way California corporations pay them. Once again, it was the people of California's interest, namely to get a fair amount of taxes from out-of-state corporations against specific organized business interests whose bottom line was going to be affected. So I actually do share your unease about money in politics, but the fact of the matter is when I've been involved, it hasn't been to support my personal interests in any way. In fact, I've been acting as a citizen trying to represent the other citizens of California against moneyed interests who've been getting their way at our expense.
What about all those moneyed interests with tax loopholes for hedge funds? I mean, there really is tremendous unfairness and inequity in terms of hedge
Completely funds. Agreed. I mean, you're referring to this what's called the carried interest exemption.
Absolutely.
And I'm against it. I absolutely think they should undo it, and I've always thought that. My rule
Would you put your money behind that?
Would I spend – first of all, it's not a California rule, so there's no proposition we could run
but
in
you're
California
on, the,
on this.
You talk about getting in the Massachusetts race. You're on the national stage now. You're even considered as a possible Secretary of Energy. You were considered to replace David Chu. By the way, did you want that job?
Look, my opinion on this whole thing has always been what I am interested in, what I've tried to do in these propositions, why we've gotten involved to the extent we have in Massachusetts is to stand up for what I think are the interests that I care the most about. I'm not interested in my resume. I mean, since I've left Fairlawn, I haven't done one thing that's good for my resume. I am very, very interested in trying to get a sensible energy policy enacted. And if I really thought that taking any job would do that, I'd be super interested, Michael. But I think you have to ask yourself, what is the best way to actually get that to happen? And then try as hard as you can, forgetting yourself in the interim, not trying to have a terrific resume for when you go up to heaven, but to actually try and get something done.
Well, if you do run for office, would you promise at this point that you wouldn't necessarily try to control how much we would drink? And I'm just thinking of other billionaires who have held offices.
The 16-ounce soda rule in New York City?
Tom Sutter, philanthropist, environmentalist, founder, and former co-managing partner of Fairlawn Capital Management. So you'd go into the ring in terms of tax fairness for hedge funds.
I've said to you within the last 120 seconds that I believe that rule should be rescinded and that they should pay it, that, you know, people in that situation should pay taxes along the same lines as everybody else, and there shouldn't be that exemption. Am I going to make it my life's work to undo that? It's not the top of my agenda. I happen to believe it's something that should be rescinded.
Talking about money in politics, though, certainly your good fortune in terms of making a lot of money has enabled you to get access to politicians. And to get an initiative on the ballot, it costs about $3 million and then some these days. And for, say, average citizens to get any kind of access to politicians who don't have the money, that's how the system works. You would concede?
Oh, look, I said at the outset, it makes me uncomfortable too. The issue is, if you're in my position and you really strongly believe that there's things that need to be changed, I'm not doing it for my own interests. I'm doing for what I think is right. And I'm accepting a system that may be imperfect, but that is what it is, the way I found it.
Let's talk about what you're doing again. Next Generation, research and communications organization focusing on climate change and families, and founder and I want to mention also another thing that you're involved in with your brother, which has to do with children and education. I mean, a lot of pies here, aren't there? Your wife with the bank in Oakland.
Well,
I mean, it's a juggling thing that's going on here in big time.
You know, my personal time has been spent overwhelmingly on energy and climate. But I would say the interests of our family are really fairly controlled. It's good energy. We try and keep it simple words. Good energy, good money, meaning we started a community bank to try and get money into poor communities to support nonprofits, businesses, whatever, in poor where there's too little money being lent. It's kind of the opposite of the old redlining, where we'd raise deposits outside poor communities and lend them in poor communities to make the community stronger. We've spent a bunch of time on food and trying to figure out how to grow healthy food in a sustainable fashion. And my brother's been a children's advocate his whole life. He's really concerned and always has been about children at risk.
And your mother and father, I mean, this is a transgenerational thing. I know you've got kids who are politically and socially committed to social change, but your dad was a major attorney, litigator. Your mother worked producing NBC News and writing for NBC News, but she also established a reading program in public schools and taught in Harlem.
Yes, she did. There's always
a lot of the social activism is in the DNA.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I was maybe 15 years old, I was having dinner with my mother and I said, Mom, you know, who are we? Who is our family? What do we stand for? And she said, look, we've never been rich or powerful, but we've always tried to be well-educated and participate in our community. And so when I think about who I am in the continuation of the people who are my ancestors and the kids who my wife and I have, I think that's who I think I'm trying to be. I'm not trying to be rich or powerful. I'm trying to be well-educated and well-informed and participate in my community fully.
And that ethos, your wife, Kat, and you have passed down to the next generation of four children?
I hope so. You know, my thesis is they're pretty much independent actors starting at about 13. That's my experience of our four kids. So I believe they're good decision makers, and I trust their instincts and their judgment.
Tom Steyer is our guest, and I'm going to open up our phone lines now and invite you to join us in conversation if you have questions or comments, if you'd like to join the conversation in general. By the way, Tom and his wife have put $40 million into what they call the Tomcat Center for Sustainable Energy at Stanford, just another of those things that are being juggled here that we've alluded to. We'll try to juggle your involvement in the program. You can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us, and our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. Where do you want this money to go with Proposition 39? Some of it's still up in the air, isn't it, in terms of to be decided?
Well, Prop 39 took half of the money that we got from the out-of-state corporations and dedicated it to renovating public office buildings and schools for energy. But it was fairly broadly defined, and it was always assumed that it would be much more tightly defined by the legislature and then allocated over time. And once the election was passed, we pushed very hard, along with a number of other people, including my honorary co-chair, Kevin DeLeon, Senator Kevin DeLeon from Los Angeles, to have the money go exclusively to schools. And we wanted that for a number of reasons. One, because you get more bang for your buck if you do the same job over and over than if you try and every job is different from the other. Second of all, the schools have been the least updated physically public structures. Third, in redoing for energy the HVAC systems, you clean the air, and we've had a terrible problem in public schools of bad air and attendant health problems like asthma. So we felt like there's a huge side benefit to this, which is the health of our kids. And fourth, to the extent we save money, which we will, these are investments where we're going to get multiples of our money back in terms of energy savings over time. That money can be reinvested in the schools in terms of books, teachers, programs, whatever. And we felt like this is just a fantastic way both for the taxpayer to get bang for the buck and to make a political statement about what we care about.
Well, you got $1 billion steered back to the state, essentially, out of that.
Per year.
Yeah.
Yes.
Per annum. If you were to run for an office, let me just put it to you that way, what would it be? What would you want to be?
Well, I have been intermittently involved in different political things, as you mentioned, including these two propositions in California. And I've really only done it when no one else has wanted to do it, or there's been what I perceive to be, and maybe other people didn't agree with me, but I perceived it, a crying need. So in Prop 23, nobody wanted to fight the oil companies. It was perceived that you'd lose, it would cost a ton of money, you'd be embarrassed. And so no one wanted to do it. I wasn't the right person to do it. I was the person who was willing to do it with George Shultz, my co-chair, who's a Republican, so we could have bipartisan, and George obviously has enormous credibility.
We're coming up at a break. We'll continue with Tom Steyer. Again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with billionaire, investor, and philanthropist and environmentalist Tom Steyer, who has emerged as a political force in California in recent years. He backed a couple of successful environmental ballot measures, and now former hedge fund manager is taking a greater role on the national stage, particularly in the fight against climate change. And he was even in the running to be President Obama's energy secretary. With us in studio, we'll go to your calls in just a moment here. Let me go to some emails. David writes, wow, this guy gets it. Connecting economic incentive with clean energy is the only way this thing will get solved. Please become Secretary of Energy. Well,
My mother has passed away. Otherwise, I would believe that she sent that in under the pseudonym David.
Here's Julie, who writes on our website, could you please ask your guests how owning a beach house on Stinson, a mansion in Pacific Heights, a huge cabin, a Sugar Bowl ski resort, and a cattle ranch fits in with being an environmentalist? He is a classic limousine liberal that has totally hypocritical. He loves to speak about and advertise that he drives a Prius, but fails to mention all his real estate holdings. You're on the griddle here, Tom.
So let's go through those. We do own a house in Pacific Heights. The cattle ranch is actually a huge environmental and scientific experiment.
You're bringing up organic food there, aren't you?
That is an attempt to show that you can raise grass-fed, grass-finished beef and a number of other animals, pigs, chickens, turkeys, in a sustainable way that will actually make the land a bigger carbon sink. We don't actually ever – that is not a house that we use as a vacation spot. That is an actual business that we're trying to show is sustainable and is a model for how people can raise animals.
Can I defend you on something here, by the way? Because obviously I don't have to be your defender or anything, but – you could fly around in a private jet and you don't, Robert Kennedy Jr., and you don't for the specific reason because of the carbon.
Look, we're trying to be decent people, and we obviously are imperfect in that. But let me just answer the other two. Stinson Beach is rented out 12 months a year. My wife does. We bought it and we used it and we now rent it out. We never go there. And the house in Sugar Bowl is rented out too. We haven't been there in years. The fact of the matter is my wife doesn't believe in ever selling anything in California because she believes California is the greatest place in the world. So if other people use it and continue to, that's great. But the fact of the matter is she believes that selling anything in California is an incredibly dumb investment decision. So of those four houses, the only one we live in and use for our entertainment is the one in Pacific Heights.
And you do ride an older car. I mean, you do ride a Prius as well.
It's actually a Honda hybrid that I bought in, I think, 2002. And so do I think I'm a perfect person on this? No. Am I trying to be a good person on this and to have a low carbon footprint? Yes, and I think that's all of our responsibility. But the biggest issue in this whole thing is not to rely on whether I'm a good person or Michael Krasny's a good person or the person who wrote this in is a good person. We need as a society to change the policies and rules so we're incented to do the right thing. It's not – I will try and do this out of the goodness of my heart and model a good life, but we need to give each other the right incentive so we want to do the things that we need to do.
And we bring more of our callers on. Paul, good morning.
Yeah, hi. My comment is I know that Tom Steyer was working in support of Prop 39 and allied with the building trades unions because, you know, there's going to be jobs coming out of those school upgrade jobs. And now, you know, working against the Keystone XL pipeline and educating people about climate change and the impacts of that, I'm wondering how he deals with the fact that a lot of those same building trades unions support the pipeline. Is there any way to, you know, some kind of educational campaign that can be waged to talk about the real numbers for jobs that will be created and how, you know, what the environmental impacts versus the job impacts are on that project? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question.
Okay, so let me say this. I absolutely worry and care about working families having a decent life. And I believe that if we do what I'm talking about on a broad scale, which isn't going to involve retrofitting an enormous number of buildings and our whole energy complex, that is going to be an enormous task for this country that is going to require enormous job creation for just the kinds of people who would otherwise be working on the XL pipeline. Now, let me say this. So I believe that the program I'm talking about will create millions of jobs for working people, millions of new jobs, millions of well-paid new jobs. That doesn't mean that every project that is a job would be good. Don't forget, in the past, sometimes organized labor was against the fuel economy standards for cars. The fact is, fuel economy standards for cars turned out to be very good business for Detroit. Their fighting those fuel economy standards was very bad for the jobs of the working people of Detroit who work in the automobile industry. What I'm talking about is building the industries of the future, retrofitting the things that we have, and all those things are huge job creators.
So when the California Manufacturers and Technology Association, I alluded to this before, said you had hurt them by your backing, well, actually being against the proposition that you opposed, that they were that weaning off fossil fuels, I think the statement was, hurts them, costs them. You're saying they really don't understand what's best for them, I think, isn't what you're saying?
I do believe that. My opinion in a lot of this is when we talk to businesses, they often have a very short-term outlook. They're really looking over a very short period of time. The fact of the matter is, as a society, we need to take into account a longer, more holistic view. So when I listen to business people as a business person, I understand that they have an integrity to what they're trying to do, that they genuinely are trying to build a good business and put make money, make profits, and put people to work. But I never believe that they're taking all of society into account for a second. I believe they're speaking their own interests. And I believe that the job, that what we need to do is include all of the citizens of California in making decisions. So I listen to them seriously. I know they're speaking with integrity from their point of view, but I never believe that they're taking a broader view.
Again, we're talking to Tom Steyer, and let me go to some more of your emails. Francis writes, thank you for this program. I'm concerned about the proposition to frack near Monterey County. Does your guest have information regarding the effect of fracking on the water, fragile ecosystem, and nearby agriculture vineyards? It is great to get away from coal. I hope we're not replacing it with natural gas that is derived from fracking.
So when I think about fracking, which is short for hydraulic fracturing, which is basically a process where you force thousands or millions of gallons of water deep into the substratum and force hydrocarbons out of tiny little crevices in the rock. That's really what we're talking about. And it's a very invasive process. And I am not a scientist, but I've spoken to people who have spent months or years studying whether this is safe. And what they've told me, and what I believe, is that in certain places, carefully regulated, it can be done without risk, not without undue risk. And so my belief is that there is a way to do this that will, in certain places, we can responsibly get these hydrocarbons, particularly natural gas, out without the big short-term risk in terms of water and the environment. The two issues here, from my point of view, are one, we absolutely have to do it in a careful, regulated way, or else it will be done poorly and there will be disasters. And secondly, the second question is, should we be taking hydrocarbons at all? So let's deal with the second question because, that is the climate change question. How should we be deciding about using hydrocarbons at all? And we need a systematic way to charge people for burning hydrocarbons for the pollution they're creating. Until we have that, it's going to be very difficult as a society for us to make consistent, good decisions, which is what we really need to do. Now, in the short term, do I think it's good to replace coal with natural gas? Yes, I do. Do I think natural gas is perfect? Very, very far from it. But do I think that that is a step in the right direction and that, that can be a step to us getting to a carbon neutral world? I do, but it's got to be done only in the places where it's safe. It's got to be done in a very carefully regulated fashion. And we have to understand that is not the end. The end is for us to have a system where we can look at this systematically and people will make good decisions taking into account all the costs.
Well, let's stay on point here because I've got a listener, Pedro from Albuquerque, who writes, I did proudly vote twice for Obama, but I unfortunately disagree on his green energy policy. Yes, we are concerned about global warming, but there is no way that coal will stop being burned on a global scale. If we do not burn coal, other countries will burn the coal as it gives them an economic advantage. Green energy is both too expensive and intermittent. Solar only produces power when the sun shines, making it very difficult to manage. Currently, there is no effective way to store energy, making solar a grid liability. We are just not ready for green energy. We need more research to become more efficient before we dig ourselves in an economic hole. And Solyndra does come to mind, unfortunately, here, almost in a Pavlovian way. But you would say what to Pedro, who just sends this email?
I would say I agree. That are we in a position right now to go to a carbon-free economy? No, absolutely not. From my point of view, can we put ourselves in that position? Absolutely. one of the things that I believe really strongly in is the ability of the United States and American business to take on huge challenges and succeed in ways that nobody imagined. So can we analogize this, please, to the information technology revolution, which if you think about the beginning of the internet in the mid-90s, when it really started to become a commercial fact, the things that are going on now, people had never imagined. It wasn't that, you know, people had never imagined Google. They'd never imagined gamification. All the things that are happening in California now, all the new businesses that are springing up around San Francisco and Silicon Valley, it's not that they didn't exist. They weren't imagined. So when I think about what Americans individually and American business can do when they're turned on to something, I think about the information technology revolution. I think about what we did to solve AIDS. I think about what we did in World War II, where we went from a standing stop to this incredible military power in 4 years. That would have been, if you'd said in December of 1941 that we could do that, people would have scoffed at you. The ability of this country to make change and lead change around the world, I think, is dramatically underestimated, including by the people in this country.
You want an ominous thought here, though, Tom? Sorry.
Please, lay it on me.
Well, we had Ray Kurzweil on. You know, he was talking about his singularity theory and actually predicting that we would find immortality. And, you know, everybody would scoff at that on the face of it. But who knows what lies beyond the threshold of time or what may be down the future for us, reversing the enzyme process. Who the hell knows? But it may be too late with global warming. So, I mean,
can I address that?
Yeah.
Look, one of the things that's happened to me in the last year is that I've become obsessed, and all of my friends can attest to this, with the urgency and timing of climate change. And what we should do about it, the strategies we should all employ, are dependent on how fast we think things are happening. Because the faster it's happening, the more aggressive we should be in our strategies, because we have to be.
Well, I hear that from people like James Hansen, Bill McKibben, you know, people who are leaders in this field. But at the same time, the warnings and the caveats are out there. We are on kind of the precipice here, are we not?
Well, we are already feeling impacts. The way that I think about it is 192 countries have decided that if the temperature rises by 3.6 degrees from the 1990 level, that would be an unacceptable level, that would be a place that we would just – that would be – something we absolutely should work as hard as we can to avoid. And 192 countries have decided that's the level of unavoidable. We're already seeing impacts. We're going to see more impacts. The question is, how hard can we work to avoid what people are saying is something that absolutely has to be avoided? And the timing on that, in my opinion, it has changed over the last year. I've decided, you know, people had been telling me that this is a mid-century problem or it's a 2040 problem. I just don't believe that anymore. I believe it is much more urgent, and therefore the need for us to make a dramatic pivot is much higher. Our ability to solve this with incremental policies and incremental technologies, where we kind of do it out of our hip pocket, but it's business as usual, I no longer believe will work.
We'll bring on more of your calls, and let me go to Lenny. Join us, Lenny. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning, and Tom, thanks for being on the show. It's fascinating listening to you. I'm heavily involved in California cap and trade and also heavily involved in renewable energy. And I've got 2 points. The first point is congratulations on your success. I don't think you need to apologize for having, you know, a place in Stinson Beach or elsewhere. You know, this is what America is about.
Thank you. I love Stinson, by the way, even if I never get to go there.
Yeah, so, you know, please, no apologies necessary. This is America. Number two, you know, fracking, specifically in California, has the ability to boost California's economy dramatically. And so long, as you pointed out, and Governor Brown agrees, it's done in an environmentally careful way, it makes no sense for us to be importing oil from places like Venezuela when we could be doing it here, which from a net perspective would be great for California's economy, and from an environmental perspective would be better than drilling it in Venezuela and places like that and then shipping it into California. And because we already have a cap on emissions beginning this year, from a CO2e perspective, California's emissions are already capped. And so I think very strongly that one of the great gifts that this country has is cheap, abundant sources of energy, and we need to be very careful to marry the environmental obligations we have for future generations, but also the existing economic obligations we have to keep this country competitive. And I'd love you to comment on that, please.
Tom Steyer.
Lenny, I take your point in terms of what this can do for us economically. The part of your argument that I agree with the most and that I think has to be emphasized is that we need to have rules about how much carbon dioxide emissions we permit. And once we have those rules the way we do in California, then the market can do whatever it wants. Because as a society, we've decided what is necessary to do to have a sustainable economy and world. And until we get that, we're going to be fighting a million brush fires that are, you know, trying to get some of the way to the right place. But ultimately, we need to have that kind of regulation intact in California, which we do, in the United States, which we don't, and around the world, because this is global pollution, global solution.
And Lenny, thank you. Since you mentioned California and global, here's a listener who writes, while investing in the large ballot measures is very commendable, Tom should consider funding small local elections for things like water agencies. Environmental decisions are often made at the local level, and I believe that is where the most difference can be made for a small amount of money, bang for the buck.
Okay, let me comment on that. One of the places where there is an enormous impact in the United States of America is the local or state public utility commissions. People don't realize how significant the decisions are made in those very unknown and overlooked agencies around the country. So one of the things that it is important for us all to do is to focus on that and make sure that the commissioners who get elected or appointed, and it's different in different states, understand what's going on in energy around the country, have the right values and motives in what they're doing. And that's something where traditionally this has been kind of a revolving door where you work for utility and then you go work as a PUC commissioner and then you go back to a utility. And so they really look at it from the point of view of the companies themselves. We really need to have public utility commissioners around the country who understand the need for a new energy economy.
You just reminded me, we used to have the PUC people on regularly. It's been a while, Dan. We should have them back. Let me get to some more of your calls. We want more of your calls. Robert, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Tom, thank you so much for this conversation and Michael for the topic. I consider myself a bit of an accidental environmentalist, and the catalyst for me was a rather emotional decision to go out and purchase an electric vehicle 6 months ago. I fell in love with the torque and speed and the fun factor of it, and then actually had to consider all the environmental and tax ramifications and everything else kind of behind the scenes. And it's really transformed my life and the life of my family. To putting in this thermostats, replacing all the light bulbs in my house, putting in a solar array, kind of this all-in approach, frankly, to try to game the system a little bit and drive as effectively as possible. But the more I invested my energy in figuring out the right way to do it, the more it just made sense on a global scale. And here in the Bay Area specifically, we have charge networks by companies like ChargePoint and Blink, and an infrastructure that was far more robust than I had any idea was already in place, and it's continuing from there. Tesla Motors has an electric vehicle that can actually meet the demands of most of the use case. And I think that Bay Area in specific and Mayor Bloomberg in New York City just proposed adding 10,000 charging stations to New York City, that we're really on the cusp of a change to the electrification of transportation. And I really like to hear where you stand on that, because it's pretty exciting from my vantage.
I like your excitement and optimism, Robert, and I thank you for that contribution. We'll hear from Tom Steyer on this, although I remember conversations with Amory Lovins going back from the Rocky Mountain Institute, and I thought, boy, this is going to happen a lot faster than it has. Tom?
Well, there are a couple things that are going on in terms of the electrification of transportation. One is, if you're going to get your transportation fuel out of the grid, you want the grid to be clean. So that's a big thing. That's why the Los Angeles change away from coal is so big. If you're getting your electricity from a grid that's coal powered, we aren't really helping ourselves very much. That's one point. Second point is the whole evolution and improvement of batteries is something where we're on a cost curve and an efficiency curve that is going to take us to a place that none of us really understand. Because the issue with electric cars is partially range anxiety, that people worry they're going to run out of juice and get stuck. It's partially the cost of the battery, because people who don't drive electric cars have in their mind the batteries that they put into their flashlights or they put into their cell phones or whatever.
Hearing aids.
These are like small beds. They're like a small cot. They're very heavy and they're very expensive. And in order for these cars to compete truly without subsidy with internal combustion engines, they've got, you know, they have to go through a long cost reduction and capability improvement. So I think we're on a curve where this is going to happen. But don't forget the other thing that's going on, which is the internal combustion engine is being improved really rapidly. So that as we bring these costs down, which we're going to do, and as these cars get more attractive, which they're going to do, and as the range gets better and all these good things happen, the internal combustion engine is, people are going to be working hard to make that better too. So I'm not expecting, you know, the internal combustion engine to go away soon. I do think that the ability for electric cars to compete head up without subsidy is going to happen because of the cost curves. Because when people really get it in their heads that this is an exciting place where you can make a lot of money, then we're going to see all kinds of new ideas that will make those cars exciting and fun to drive. Because don't forget, a lot of people love their ride and they like to have fun with their ride. And that's, you know, you were saying that handling is really great. Well, some of these cars are going to provide experiences that people are going to love.
You're really an optimist, aren't you? You get that from your mother, too?
The future belongs to the optimist, Michael. Never forget that.
I'll bear it in mind. Let me get some more listeners via email here. Here's Jason, who writes, I'm a homeowner with solar and electric vehicle. I advocate this combination for the estimated 80 million vehicles in the U.S. that can take advantage of it, households with two cars. In a total of 4 years, I will have paid for my solar in savings, and for at least 20 years thereafter, I will drive and have home electricity for free. Bonus, EVs are simply better vehicles. Can Mr. Steyer take an advocating this important win-win message? And actually, along with that, is a listener named Jenny who writes, I think every conversation in every context about global warming should start with conversation. We hear a lot of talk with conservation, excuse me. We hear a lot of talk about alternative energy and efficient cars, all of which are important. That said, shouldn't the first words every time be drive less, turn off your lights, keep your thermostat at a reasonable temp, hang out your washing, et cetera? It seems obvious, easy, and potentially enormously effective. These are both practical and worthwhile,
absolutely,
wise suggestions, yeah.
Look, the thing that we did in Prop 39 was to say, let's retrofit state schools, basically, is what I think we're going to end up with, I hope we're going to end up with, to save energy. The best energy we can ever create is the energy we don't use. So I absolutely agree that we waste enormous amounts of energy. I mean, just the fact that we have the grid up all night, if you don't use energy, it disappears. So we waste enormous amounts of energy at night when nobody has their lights on and nobody is using any TVs or washing machines. So our ability to be more efficient is dramatic.
Just turn off your computers.
There's all kinds of stuff we can do. But the big thing that we have to face is that we need to determine that this is important as a society. We have to make a dramatic change. I think we've made it in California, but I don't think we've made it in the rest of the country. But I think we need to openly discuss the need to do this. I think climate has been a taboo subject in the United States of America. If you listened to the 2012 presidential election, the word climate never came up. There were lots of words that did come up, like clean coal, which I'm not sure exactly what that means, but that was one that was used a lot. And I think we need, as a society, to accept the fact both that this is something that has to happen and that it's something we can succeed at and do a tremendous job at and take enormous pride and be better off as a result.
Just had an involuntary memory of Jeremy Rifkin talking about hydrogen on this program and really looking at hydrogen as the future. I mean, clean energy and so forth. What's happened to hydrogen?
Well, there's still work being done. I mean, the funny thing is, if you spend your time on this, which I have been doing, is you realize that the research opportunities on this are incredibly numerous. And you never know which one is going to turn out to be fantastic. And I would analogize this. I remember living in San Francisco when we really had no ability to combat AIDS. And I had a bunch of doctor friends who said, you know, there's an enormous amount of research dollars and effort and attention being spent on how to control the AIDS virus. And here we are now. We never really got the single silver bullet that said, you know, take this pill and you'll never get AIDS.
No, but we're closer to a vaccine than we ever imagined.
And we came up with a cocktail. We came up with a whole bunch of things.
But aside from the protease cocktail, now we are really on the verge of a vaccine, finally.
And would we ever? In 1985, people were despairing. They felt like this is something that could be, you know, we will never be able to handle. American research, American
ingenuity,
combination of research and business has made this a problem where we think we can see a real solution and where in the interim we've made enormous strides. And so I'm saying, please do not look at American business and research and think nothing's going to happen. If we decide we have to do this, we have enormous capability, enormous resources, and we can make this happen. And the people who are resisting it will be right at the forefront of making it happen and being proud of it.
We're talking to Tom Steyer, philanthropist, environmentalist, and optimistic evangelical in many respects. Good to hear that kind of enthusiasm, and I hope you're right. I hope you're right. Fact is, we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, trying to solve problems like this and trying to bring things to your attention, sometimes zealously and passionately. And Tom Steyer has emerged as certainly a political force. We'll continue to follow you, and I thank you very much for being with us. And if we want to go back, actually mention that you're co-founder of Next Generation, too. Let's get that on the record again. We're here with you, as I said, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Always like to hear from you, so let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And we want to let you know who's responsible behind the scenes. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.